also went to for those jokes this morning, you will discover something about the history of Father's Day. The funny thing, Ali, is that Warren Honke at the 8 o'clock service also went to the same... Oh, he gave them to you. Okay. That's all right. I thought we've all Googled the same websites for our research today. But actually, the origins of Father's Day are more obscure than the origins of the Garden of Eden. There seems to be more than one version about how Father's Day came into existence. And from what I can tell, all the versions are American versions. So 100 years ago this year, on July the 5th, 1908, a special Memorial Father's Day was held, a service was held in the town of Fairmont, West Virginia in the United States. And a local holiday was declared in response to a mining disaster that had occurred the year before in which many fathers of the town had been killed. Now this service is alleged to be the beginnings of Father's Day. But I'm not sure how authentic this is, because I just want to point out that Fairmont, West Virginia, is also renowned, if that's the right word, as the home of the original pepperoni roll. Another story goes that Father's Day... Yeah, I don't know, but it's funny, isn't it? Yeah. Another story goes that Father's Day is really just an afterthought after Mother's Day. A woman by the name of Sonora Dodd in the town of Spokane, again in the United States, was sitting in church during a Mother's Day service about 100 years ago, and she noticed that it was unfair that mothers got their special day, but dads didn't. Now, her own dad had been a single parent to six children after his wife had died young, and so Sonora chose his birthday, June the 19th, as the date to celebrate it, which is the reason that's such a popular date around the world. So she started a campaign which was picked up with enthusiasm by the local mayor and later by businesses who wanted to sell more socks, ties and men's toiletries. And today we have Father's Day pretty much all around the world. Now, I've been a father since 1972 for 36 years, and it may surprise you to know that Judy has been a mother for exactly the same time. And the reason we're really disappointed that we have to wait another week is that today is our 40th wedding anniversary. So we expect the same applause next week too. I have to say, fathering has changed a lot since 1972. In 1972, this father waited at home for the phone call from the doctor to tell him the baby had arrived. Now, these days, a father must wear a hospital gown, be present, of course, know how to be a breathing coach, and how to work the video camera as well. In 1972, this father looked forward to teaching his children how to ride a bicycle. Now, a father waits for his children to come home to teach him how to use the DVD and how to program Foxtel. In 1972, this father used to smoke a pipe. Now, such a father would be sent outdoors after his children had lectured him about the perils of cancer. Quite rightly, too. In 1972, this father looked forward to gently waking his kids awake and saying, "Wake up, it's time for school." Nowadays, a father is shaken awake at 4 a.m. by his son or daughter who shouts, "Wake up, Dad, it's time for swim training." In 1972, this father would come home from work to find his family sitting around the table waiting for him to say grace. Now a father comes home to a note. "Jay's at footy training, Tamara's at gymnastics, I'm at computer class, pizza's in the fridge." In 1972, this father expected to have a heart-to-heart with his son while we went fishing. Nowadays, fathers pull those little white earphones out of their son's ears and say, "When you have a minute..." I read somewhere, I think it was probably in Woman's Day, in fact I'm certain it was in Woman's Day, that eventually the female reproductive system will evolve to make fathers unnecessary. It would have to be Woman's Day, right? Well, apparently, guys, this day is still pretty far off. So until that day comes, there's one thing that we can say that we all have in common, and that is that we all had fathers, or have fathers. There may be some of you here who don't know your fathers. Perhaps father left the family when you were young. Or maybe there's one or two who are test tube babies But even in that case, a father was involved at some point in the process. So in every case, at least until the Woman's Day prophecy comes true, there was a father involved somewhere. We all have that in common. What we don't have in common is what kind of fathers we had. Some of us will remember our fathers with great fondness, with great love. Some of us will remember our fathers with misgivings, some good memories, some bad memories. Some of us will remember our fathers with such bitterness, perhaps even hatred, so much that we'd rather forget them than remember them. Now, my own father was a hard-working, self-contained man. He kind of hovered in the background of our childhood. I had two sisters. My mother was much more in the foreground. She was an extroverted, demonstrative, fun kind of a person. And Dad seemed more serious. He worked long hours. He provided well for us. But he was a presence more than a part of our lives. You turned to him for advice and help. He made things for us. He was an engineer, and he could turn his hand to carpentry, which meant that one of the things that he did to express his love for me was to build my whole bedroom furniture to a design that we created together, but which also meant that while I spent a lot of time in my bedroom, he spent a lot of time at his carpentry bench. Now, he loved my sister and me quite enough to buy us a car, but that meant he spent more time in the garage repairing it. My dad was a man of culture and arts. When he preached, which he did, he quoted Shakespeare just as much as the scriptures. He liked to listen to classical music, and he bought records every month from the World Record Club. A few ancient nods there, I notice. He could conduct any choir, and he could sing any harmony part. If he heard the altos were going off, he immediately knew what the problem was, and he could sing it for them. He'd never had the chance to learn a musical instrument, but he made sure that me and my sisters had that chance. He stayed in regular contact with his extended family, so we saw our grandparents and our aunts and uncles and our cousins quite a lot. And for a few years, he even lived in his grandfather's house, caring for my great-grandfather in his last few years. And when his younger sister was diagnosed with cancer, he and Mum bought a house 100 kilometres away so that they could be near her and support her. So he was a man who knew how to love, but he was not an easy man to hug. And yet I'm sure he was the kind of man who yearned to be hugged. But what about other fathers? What about your father? Your father like mine? Better? Worse? A few weeks ago I sat at a table with a young man who'd been homeless and had been helped by the Melbourne City Mission. And he told us his story. How at the age of 14, he'd become the primary carer for a bipolar mother and a 7-year-old sister. He told how his mother, being bipolar, she would have these moments of frantic activity, and her methodology in those moments of frantic activity was to shop extravagantly with money, because she did not have. He said, we got a very nice expensive sofa for a few weeks until reality hit in over at Harvey Norman. And his mum almost got them a first-class trip to Thailand. And then, of course, she would descend into the depths of depression, and there she would turn violent and have murderous fits that had this young teen taking his little sister and escaping into the streets. And finally, the streets seemed safer than home. And he became one of those homeless people who sleep on any spare couch and occasionally find themselves under a bridge or in an alley somewhere. At the age of 19, he found his way to Front Yard at the Melbourne City Mission, and over the next 2 years, through the program of support that's provided there, he got his life together. Well, today he's finishing a social work degree, and you know, he wants to work with homeless youth. As I thought about this young man later, I realized that nowhere in his whole story had he mentioned his father. A father who, putting the pieces together, must have left him and his sister and his mother when he was 14. And I wondered, where was this father? And what kind of a father would abandon such a family? Doubtless for some of us today, Father's Day, a day that reminds you of your father, isn't a good day. The actress Lindsay Lohan was reported this week as describing her father as a bully and a public embarrassment. I thought the second one was rather ironic coming from Lindsay herself, but it wouldn't be unusual in a group of this size in which that there would be no one who recalled their father as a tyrant or a bully. I'm sure there are people in this room who had fathers like that. So what are we to say about Father's Day? Well, I guess we can say they come in all kinds. A few of them are great, a few of them are evil, and probably most in between are sometimes terrific and sometimes terrifying. Now, the theological problem we have here is that God is described as God the Father. And if we don't carry around in our heads and hearts a good image of a father, then this can colour our idea of what God is like. I mean, if you suffered abuse from a violent father, then someone telling you that God is like a father isn't very helpful. Well, fortunately, the Bible does not say that God the Father is like your father or like my father. Instead, Jesus described God the Father in the story we heard this morning, the story of the lost son or the prodigal son, the story of the son who asks for his inheritance before the father is dead, who then goes and spends the inheritance on wasteful living, and then returns to beg employment from his own father. The story is titled The Prodigal Son, but it's really the story about three people. The wasteful son is obviously one of those people. The older brother is the second person. We didn't read the little sequel to the story this morning about the older brother. But today I just want to suggest a few things about the third character in the story, which is the father. Incidentally, I was reminded in preparing this sermon that our friends Annette and Charles Lovett have just been in St. Petersburg in Russia. The most famous painting of the prodigal son with his father and the other son is a painting by Rembrandt, and it hangs in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. We've got a copy of it up there, and I've got an A3 version. This is a painting by Rembrandt. It's hanging in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. I hope they saw it. I'd like to know how big it is, because I don't know. And the painting is called The Return of the Prodigal Son. It portrays the father welcoming the lost son home. The prodigal son kneels with his back to us in front of the father, before the old man. The father puts his hands on the back of the son. The older brother stands off to the right. You can see his face lit in the top right-hand corner. And in the shadows in behind, you can just see the faces of a couple of servants. You know, you don't have to have a theology degree to work out that Jesus was meaning for us to think of the Father as representing God the Father in this story. And maybe also to put ourselves in the place of one, or probably actually both, of the sons. The image of the Father that Jesus portrays in this story would have been quite extraordinary to the listeners in the first century. He's not a typical father of that time, not at all. And that should help us if sometimes we feel that our images of our own fathers have been less than perfect. God the Father is a special kind of dad. One of the startling things about Jesus' image in this story of the Father is the way the Father runs. He runs to greet his son, his returning son. Now, even today in Middle Eastern societies, the father figure of the family never runs anywhere. He is a stately figure. He glides along. The dignified pace of the Middle Eastern patriarch is a sign of the patriarch's position in the society. And what does this father do? He runs to greet his son. There's a saying in the Middle East that a man's manner of walking tells you what he is. And Aristotle said, great men never run in public. What the father is doing here in the story is drawing dramatic attention away from the son and towards himself. And he's doing it to draw away from the returning son the humility, the hostility of the community, and the humility and the humiliation that comes with that hostility. He's protecting the son, and he's restoring him to fellowship within the community by running and making a public spectacle of himself. Yet, when Rembrandt painted this picture, he doesn't present the father running. The old man stands, hunched over his returned son. The father looks fragile. He's not hugging the boy like it actually says in the Bible. Indeed, the father looks like he might be blind. His hands touch the son's back as though he is experiencing the boy's return through his touch. One of the great Christian men of the 20th century was Henri Nouwen. Now, Henri was once travelled to the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, and he sat for days in front of this painting. He sat and contemplated and meditated on the meaning of the parable and the meaning of Rembrandt's interpretation of the parable. And as a result of that, he wrote this meditation that's called The Return of the Prodigal Son, which is the name of that painting. And I want to finish by reading some of his meditations, because he says better than anybody I've ever read what the painting tells us and the parable tells us about God the Father. Instead of it being called The Return of the Prodigal Son, it could have easily been called The Welcome of the Compassionate Father. The emphasis is less on the son than on the father. The parable is in truth a parable of the father's love. Looking at the way in which Rembrandt portrays the father, there came to me a whole new interior understanding of tenderness, mercy, and forgiveness. Seldom, if ever, has God's immense compassionate love been expressed in such a poignant way. Every detail of the father's figure, his facial expression, his posture, the colours of his dress, and most of all, the still gesture of his hands, speaks of the divine love for humanity that existed from the beginning and ever will be. Everything comes together here. What gives Rembrandt's portrayal of the Father such an irresistible power is that the most divine is captured in the most human. I see a half-blind man, old man, with a moustache and a parted beard, dressed in a gold-embroidered garment and a deep red cloak, laying his large, stiffened hands on the shoulders of his returning son. This is very specific, concrete, very describable. But I also see infinite compassion, unconditional love, everlasting forgiveness, divine realities emanating from a father who is the creator of the universe. It's of special significance that Rembrandt chose a nearly blind old man to communicate God's love. It seems that the hands that touch the back of the returning son are the instruments of the father's inner eye. The near-blind father sees far and wide. He sees his seeing is an eternal seeing, a seeing that reaches out to all of humanity. It's a seeing that understands the lostness of women and men of all times and places, that knows with immense compassion the suffering of those who have chosen to leave home, those that cried oceans of tears as they got caught in anguish and agony. The heart of the father burns with an immense desire to bring his children home. Oh, how much would he have liked to talk to them, to warn them against the many dangers they were facing, and to convince them that at home can be found everything that they search for elsewhere. How much would he have liked to pull them back with his fatherly authority and hold them close to himself so that they would not get hurt. But his love is too great to do any of that. It cannot force, constrain, push or pull. It offers the freedom to reject that love or to love in return. It is precisely the immensity of the divine love that is the source of the divine suffering. God, creator of heaven and earth, has chosen to be, first and foremost, a father. As father, he wants his children to be free, free to love. That freedom includes the possibility of their leaving home, going to a distant country, and losing everything. The father's heart knows all the pain that will come from that choice, but his love makes him powerless to prevent it. As father, he desires that those who stay at home enjoy his presence and experience his affection, but here again, he only wants to offer a love that can be freely received. He suffers beyond telling when his children honour him only with lip service, while their hearts are far from him. He knows their deceitful tongues and disloyal hearts, but he cannot make them love him without losing his true fatherhood. As father, the only authority he claims for himself is the authority of compassion. That authority comes from letting the sins of his children pierce his heart. There is no lust, greed, anger, resentment, jealousy, or vengeance in his lost children that has not caused immense grief to his heart. The grief is so deep because the heart is so pure. From the deep inner place where love embraces all human grief, the father reaches out to his children. The touch of his hands, radiating inner light, seek only to heal. Here is the God I want to believe in, a father who, from the beginning of creation, has stretched out his arms in merciful blessing, never forcing himself on anyone, but always waiting. Never letting his arms drop down in despair, but always hoping that his children will return so that he can speak words of love to them and let his tired arms rest on their shoulders. His only desire is to bless. In Latin, to bless is benedicere, which means literally saying good things. The father wants to say, more with his touch than with his voice, good things of his children. He has no desire to punish them. They've already been punished excessively by their own inner or outer waywardness. The father wants simply to let them know that the love they have searched for in such distorted ways has been, is, and always will be there for them. The father wants to say more with his hands than his mouth, "You are my beloved, on you my favor rests." He is the shepherd, feeding his flock, gathering lambs in his arms, holding them against his breast. The true center of Rembrandt's painting is the hands of the Father. On them, all the light is concentrated. On them, the eyes of the bystanders are focused. In them, mercy becomes flesh. Upon them, forgiveness, reconciliation, and healing come together. And through them, not only the tired son, but also the worn-out father, find their rest. Praise be to God, the Father.